Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Yogic Studies Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell, and this is episode 23 with Dr. Patton Burchett of William & Mary College in Virginia. In today's episode, I sit down with Patton to discuss his upcoming online course, A History of Yoga and Devotion. We talk about his recent book entitled A Genealogy of Devotion, Bhakti, Tantra, Yoga, and Sufism in North India. So we get into and unpack all of those different categories and traditions and discuss the ways in which they're interrelated and have influenced each other throughout India's history, but particularly in North India during the Mughal period, which is really the focus of Patton's research, his expertise, and what he'll be sharing with us in this upcoming course. YS115, A History of Yoga and Devotion, will run live from April 26th through May 21st, 2021, and it'll be available for self-study anytime thereafter. You can find out more about Patton and all the details for this course if you visit yogicstudies.com/YS-115. Dr. Patton Burchett is an assistant professor of religious studies at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. He earned his PhD in South Asian religions from Columbia University in 2012, and then spent 3 years as an assistant professor and faculty fellow in religious studies at New York University. Patton's research focuses on early modern devotional bhakti traditions and tantric and yogic religiosity in North India, and on the interrelations of magic, science, and religion in the rise of Indian and Western modernities. He's the author of numerous articles and book chapters on bhakti literature and Mughal-era Indian religious history, among other topics. And his first book, which we'll be talking about in this episode and we'll be reading chapters of in the course, is entitled A Genealogy of Devotion, Bhakti, Tantra, Yoga, and Sufism in North India, published by Columbia University Press in 2019. All right, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Patton Burchett. All right, I am here joined with Patton Burchett. It's a sunny Thursday afternoon here in California. Patton, welcome to the Yogic Studies Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. Tell us, where are you tuning in from today?
Hi, Seth. Thanks for having me on. It is an honor to be here. I am tuning in from Charlottesville, Virginia, and it is also a nice, sunny, clear spring day.
Nice. And are you kind of wrapping up a semester of teaching there at William & Mary College?
Indeed. I am. The semester is coming to a close in about a month, so we're pushing into final exams, final papers, and all those good things.
Mm-hmm. And have you guys been 100% online?
Exactly. That's why I'm here in Charlottesville, which is actually the home of UVA, but I'm living here at the moment. Williamsburg, where William and Mary is about 2 hours down the road. So I've been able to do it all online. All my classes are virtual at the moment. We're all looking forward to being back in person in the fall.
For sure. Yeah. But we've all become expert online Zoomers and online teachers now. And the benefit, of course, for you is you get to be home there with your family, and you can teach remotely, right?
Exactly. That has been one kind of unexpected silver lining to the pandemic, is I haven't had to do what would have been a tough commute, and I've got to have a lot of extra family time.
Yeah, for sure. Well, just to kind of get us started here, let me just say, you know, it was really... I was really pleased to get your email when you reached out to me. I think maybe you had listened to my podcast with Raj on the New Books Network, where I kind of told my story a bit and talked about yogic studies and my research. And you just sent a really nice email, and kind of checking in about yogic studies and just putting a feeler out there if I'd be interested in having you teach a course on yoga and bhakti. And just the timing of that email couldn't have been more perfect. I was, you know, really wanting to develop a course on yoga and bhakti, as we've spoken about. You know, it's such an important topic within just the broader field of yoga studies, but also just kind of the broader field of Hinduism and Indian religions. And it's something that gets mentioned a lot in yoga, but I feel like really needed its own course. And who better to teach this course than Patton Burchett, I thought. So when you reached out, I was really touched by that. You know, I've been a long fan of your work, your scholarship on these topics. You're somebody who's further along than me and somebody I had kind of always looked up to as sort of a model, actually, for this type of scholarship. So I just wanted to say thanks for sending that nice email, and it was just, you know, really good timing.
Of course. No, I really appreciate that. And you're right that it was on the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast, I believe your interview with Raj Balkaran, that I really connected with a lot of what you were talking about and talking about your own journey. And so wanted to reach out and just praise you on this, this yogic studies venture, which has just been amazing. And I'm so glad that you felt like this course on bhakti, on devotion and yoga would be a good addition to all the great stuff you already offer.
Yeah. So I want to get into all of that. You know, we'll do a deep dive into, this upcoming course and, you know, thinking about bhakti and the relationship between yoga and devotion. But before we get there, maybe we can start by backing up a little bit, and maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit for our listeners and community, and tell us a little bit about your story. You know, how did you get into the study of Indian religion, to researching bhakti and yoga? What was kind of your journey into all of this?
That's a great question. Yeah, I definitely, I don't think I or anyone close to me would have imagined I would have ended up doing this if you talked to me early on in my life. And when I went to undergrad, I went to Davidson College, little small liberal arts school in North Carolina.
Oh yeah, famous for where Stephen Curry went.
Exactly. And I've started off.
And Patton Burchett, of course.
Right. Just barely below.
Right. It goes Steph and then Patton, 1 and 2 at Davidson.
Something like that. It was a great place. I loved my time at Davidson, but I started off pre-med, and it by the end of that first year, I knew that was not for me. But I did not know what I wanted to do. So I did exactly what you're supposed to do, and I don't think enough people do anymore, but especially what you're supposed to do at a liberal arts university, is I just used that time to explore my interest and figure out what it was I wanted to do with my life. And so I took courses in just all the stuff that I thought was cool, that was interesting. So I was taking courses in anthropology, psychology, philosophy, and religious studies. And the course that really changed everything for me is a Hindu studies course that I took with William Mahoney. Bill Mahoney was the resident expert at Davidson College. And his course just blew me away. And I ended up taking everything I possibly could from him, Buddhist studies, Islamic studies, ended up majoring in religious studies, but doing more at that point, more of a kind of a world religions track, just learning about every tradition I could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mahoney, he has that great book, The Artful Universe, right?
That's right. I think his expertise is more in Vedic studies, but The Artful Universe is really a beautiful, beautifully written book and interpretation of kind of Vedic philosophy. Highly recommended. I use sections of it in my intro Hinduism class, and this really love it. But he's just, I mean, what maybe you could see it potentially in reading that book, but he's just a phenomenal teacher. And sitting in his class, you know, it just occurred to me one day that, you know, he really impacted the way I saw the world. He made me question a lot of my assumptions. He made me just see everything in a new light. And that was just super exciting at the time. And I felt like, you know, what would be more valuable than to try to do what he's doing for me, to try to do that for other students. So I kind of decided then that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to teach about these kinds of traditions. And that was probably junior year or so when I had that realization, but there was a long road ahead, of course. And I can get into some of that if you want, but yeah, that was the beginning point.
Yeah. Well, just to, before you kind of tell us what happened next, the long road ahead, which indeed it is, I think it just resonates with me. I think, you know, so many of us who kind of do this professionally, it all started with, you know, one or two inspiring teachers like that in undergrad who, you know, they tend to be not just great scholars, but just inspiring human beings and just really impactful teachers. And I think, yeah, without those sort of experiences, it's less likely you kind of get pulled into this. But with them, it's life-changing, you know. And that really is, as you're saying, what college is all about, you know, exploring all these different areas of interest and being inspired and transformed. But I think within, like, the religious studies context, there's kind of a special context for that type of exploration of the fundamental human questions. And so many of us kind of catch that bug and really get pulled into this and realize, you know, this is something that you want to do beyond just college.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
So that kind of immediately pulled you into India. And then did you...
That's not how it happened. I was really interested in Hinduism. But at that point I was also maybe even more drawn towards Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And I had an ROTC scholarship, Army ROTC to Davidson. So what that meant is when I graduated, I had to go into active duty. Mm. And so all these plans for grad school and such, were on hold. So I joined the Army Quartermaster Corps, and I went to Korea for my first assignment. I was there for a year, and that was when 9/11 happened. So it was a crazy time to be in the Army.
Oh, wow.
And I came back from Korea and finished out my remaining 3 years, and was fortunate enough, honestly, to be able to get out then, because I had a whole bunch of friends who were involuntarily extended, which was a normal thing that was being done because we were at war at the time.
Did you stay in Korea during that time, or did you get restationed elsewhere?
I was just in Korea for a year, and the last 3 years I was at Fort Lee in Petersburg, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so when the whole time, you know, it's 4 years is a long time, right? And I maintained that passion, that interest to want to come back to do this, to be, you know, a scholar and teacher of religions. But it wasn't easy to maintain that when you're living this other life. And in any case, when the time came to apply to grad school, I had a tough decision to make, because I had ended up doing an honors thesis at Davidson on Chan Buddhism. So, and on kind of the acculturation of Indian traditions and cultural kind of themes into Chinese culture and tradition, in that tradition. And I was just, you know, so I was already in that undergrad thesis trying to merge an interest in India and China. But it became clear that when you go to grad school, you need to focus, for very good reasons, in a particular kind of cultural area, get linguistic experience, mm-hmm. cultural experience. And so I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had this East Asia experience in Korea. It almost seemed more logical to go into East Asian Buddhism, which was the other option.
Had you studied any Korean while you were out there?
A little bit. I wouldn't say, yeah, I I'd only been there a year, so I'd picked up a little bit, but I hadn't, you know, studied it properly. Mm-hmm. That was a route that I seriously considered taking, though. But there was just something that, you know, brought me, you know, in the end, I thought back to Bill Mahoney's classroom, and there are facets of the Indian, of the Hindu tradition that I just felt weren't in East Asian culture, that I couldn't leave behind, just kind of the role of the emotions and the arts, that the way that they're infused in so many of the rich traditions of Hinduism, rasa theory, things like that, that I was really attracted to. So I applied for South Asia, and at the time Davidson's such a small school, we didn't have any South Asian languages. So I needed to go to an MA program to get some language training, and it all worked out quite well, because I ended up at Indiana University in Bloomington and studied under David Haberman, who was another really formative influence. For those of you that don't know David Haberman's work, he is a brilliant scholar. He has a amazing book that's still often used in intro classes today, Journey Through the 12 Forests, on his ethnographic experiences.
Actually, it's funny. I read both Mahoney and Haberman's books as an undergrad in college as well. And both books were influential.
Yeah. He also is a great teacher. So I really felt lucky there. And, you know, not to make this too long of a tale, but I applied from Indiana to PhD programs and was able to get into Columbia. And there is... there I studied under Jack Hawley, who is this John Stratton Hawley, premier scholar of Bhakti, arguably in North India, at least arguably the premier scholar of Bhakti out there. And so that was a boon. He was my mentor. And when I went to Columbia, I thought I was going to study Tantra. My MA thesis was on Abhinavagupta, this wonderful, you know, amazing intellectual tantrika theologian, philosopher, aesthete from Kashmir. And I had written about the ways that his aesthetic theory, what he thought about the arts and their impact, how that kind of intersected with his more strictly religious and tantric writings. And I thought that's the project I wanted to pursue further at Columbia. But once I started getting under Jack Hawley's wing, it was all about Bhakti, and I was on board. I just started seeing the kind of that helped me to see some kind of interesting connections between Bhakti and Tantra, since I had this original interest in Tantra. And
I was going to say that really makes sense with where your research within kind of Bhakti studies went, because you really, you know, found a way to bring Tantra and yoga, as we'll talk about, kind of into conversation and dialogue with Bhakti, which is something that had been really lacking in a critical way.
Exactly. Yep. When you look at it in hindsight, it makes sense. You don't see it at the time, but I think that's exactly what happened. And John Stratton Hawley, Jack Hawley, has recently put out this book, Storm of Songs, on the history of the Bhakti movement, the sort of trope. And he was working on that book, I didn't even realize it, as I was his student. So I'm getting the chance to take all these in-depth seminars from him. And, you know, he's thinking through that book in these seminars, the material he's assigning and what we're reading. And in certain ways, my book is in conversation with that book because of that process. And
Nice. Well, you were really fortunate in having some incredible mentors and, you know, academic gurus kind of in this field, I think at every stop of the way. No wonder kind of you've now gone on to write what I'm holding in my hands, which is this just fantastic book, A Genealogy of Devotion, which hopefully we can get into here in a little bit. Okay, so that kind of brings us up to your dissertation research, which then became this book. You're now associate professor at William and Mary College. Let's switch gears a little bit now and kind of just dive into some of these topics. Let's just begin. You know, we'll throw you what is the simplest question, but also kind of the most complex. So what is bhakti?
Oh, what is bhakti? That is the question. Yeah, I think it's better almost left as an open question. But, you know, I think the starting point is just the simple translation that in English that we most often use, devotion. And then from there, you say, okay, well, what do we mean by devotion? And you start to say, what are the etymological roots of this word bhakti? And you start to see that those etymological roots are related to words like participation. And
bhaj, right, is the root in Sanskrit.
Exactly. And, you know, the kinds of participation suggests a sort of dynamic, active relationship between the devotee and God. And it also suggests a sort of intrinsically social character to whatever this devotion is. And so that already kind of helps to distinguish it from many of us in the West, at least. We're kind of, even if you're not Christian, you're kind of operating out of Protestant Christian assumptions about what religion is and what devotion is, what devotion means. So when you hear the word devotion as the translation of bhakti, it's very easy to just, without even intentionally meaning to think about, well, that must be what I think of as Christian devotion, as Protestant Christian devotion. And that's the kind of one of the first steps is to think about, well, that's not an accurate understanding of what bhakti is, what the devotional tradition is in the Indian cultural context. So how can we distinguish it from those Protestant Christian associations and connotations? And that's where, again, that kind of etymological, looking at the etymological roots, at this root verb bhaj, it's a good start. And I think also to answer the question, one thing that's helpful is the term bhajan. Many people are aware that the term bhajan is usually just thought, you know, just referred to as a devotional song. But strictly speaking, it could be translated as to do bhakti, like an action noun. And it's very interesting that the word for devotional song could be translated as to do bhakti, the doing of bhakti. So what you see there, and this is a point that Jack Hawley has made, is how central song and singing are in the devotional tradition. You started off with that big question, what is bhakti? And I mean, the only other thing I'd say beyond this sort of introductory comments is that that's what my book is largely about, is trying to show that different traditions at different points in time have thought about bhakti in different ways. And one particularly useful way to see what bhakti meant to them, what devotion meant to them, is to see what it looked like in relation to kind of other key terms like yoga, like tantra. How was bhakti related to these other things? How did it fit in with ritual? How did it fit in with knowledge? And when you put it in relation to those and in specific contexts, specific communities at specific times, you see that it meant different things, but you can also see certain areas of overlap and core meaning over time.
So some scholars have kind of articulated bhakti or even defined bhakti as kind of an individual's devotion or worship of a particular deity, or, you know, a particular form of the deity, whether it's Krishna or Rama, Shiva, the goddess, and so forth. Some scholars look at bhakti as the very internal and individualized kind of expression of religiosity, whereas others have highlighted the more social, communal, and even external aspects of bhakti. It's kind of like the old private versus public dimensions of religion question. This is something you talk about quite a bit in your book. What can you tell us about this, and kind of where do you fall on bhakti as individual versus social?
I think it can be either, but I tend to gravitate more towards the understanding of bhakti as social. Ultimately, even the social is going to be experienced by individuals. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, something about bhakti as participation, there's something about it for me that is intrinsically social, that it brings people together. So I think that understanding of devotion as individual and private is exactly, those are exactly the connotations that I, that are Protestant and Christian. And it's not to say there aren't moments that Hindu devotees are having very private experiences that are in some sense devotional with a personal God, which is often how, devotion has been thought about in the Christian tradition, a kind of personal relationship with a personal God. That certainly is a piece. Mm-hmm. But I think what's distinctive about bhakti tradition, the bhakti traditions in the Hindu context, and even beyond the Hindu context, the Indian context, because not only Hindu traditions are part of the larger bhakti tradition, but I think this social element of it, bringing people together, bringing, an individual together in relationship with God, and different individuals together in relationship with each other. So relationship is really at the heart of it. And that relationship is often infused with emotion. And that's not to say that bhakti has to always be fundamentally about ecstatic emotional experience, but I do think one of the predominant themes of bhakti traditions is the expression and cultivation of emotion in relationship with God and in relationship with fellow devotees.
Mm. So sometimes bhakti is described as like the central practice or concept, if you will, really of popular or mainstream Hinduism. So what can you tell us about just the relationship between bhakti and Hinduism? And is bhakti unique to the Hindu traditions?
Good question. I think that you could certainly make a valid case that sort of mainstream popular Hinduism today is largely, a function of bhakti traditions, of devotional traditions, maybe side by side with a sort of Advaita Vedanta theology and philosophy, that these are kind of fundamental pillars of modern Hinduism. But I also think it's easy to sort of think about bhakti in a particular way when one says that, because bhakti is not the same thing necessarily as just as puja. If puja is the word for Hindu worship, mm-hmm. and if you take an introduction to Hinduism class and you learn about all the different sort of ritual practices and ways that Hindus relate to the divine, you learn about darshan, the viewing of the divine image, and you learn about just the ways that you interact with the image, the way that you receive prasad, so the blessing of food that's then given back once blessed by God to the devotee and consumed, the arti, the circling of light, fire, in front of the divine image as a way to honor the image and to be blessed through the light and fire as a devotee. All these are kind of fundamental practices of Hindu worship that I don't think should be equated with bhakti, because then it sort of makes, but they can be infused with the sentiment of devotion. But those, I think, are things that are conceptually maybe different, puja and bhakti. So
would you say puja is a method or a practice of bhakti?
I think one could say that, yes, but I tend to want to define bhakti more narrowly. I almost think puja is the broader category, that most Hindus are going to be performing puja, but they might not be part of bhakti traditions. Their overall sort of sensibility might not be one that is where bhakti is predominant. So tantric traditions, yogic traditions are often going to involve puja in their religious life. And in some general sense, that is an act of devotion. So in the most general sense, yes, it's an act of bhakti to perform puja. Mm-hmm. But for me, that kind of can muddy the waters and water down the distinctions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So it kind of leads to a follow-up question. It sounds like maybe for you, maybe a more refined definition or sensibility of bhakti is one that ties it to a particular bhakti tradition. And maybe that might lead to a conversation about, you know, what bhakti really looks like historically, yeah, and in practice by thinking about different bhakti traditions. But before we get maybe too deep into specific traditions, and especially those traditions that you focus on in the book, maybe another way we could frame this and a question I have for you is about the difference between nirguna and saguna bhakti. One often, you know, hears about this, reads about it in a, you know, secondary book or, you know, university class on Hinduism. Tell us a little bit about that divide or that classification of different orientations to bhakti, nirguna and saguna. And then again, is this something that you find is actually useful when kind of really looking at, you know, bhakti in the wild?
Gotcha. Okay, yeah, the distinction nirgun and sagun, the word gun or guna is quality. So this is worship of a god in a nirgun tradition. A nirguna tradition is worship of God without qualities, without form, whereas worship of God with form, sa, with qualities, saguna, this would be the more probably you might even say standard, the one that form of kind of Hindu worship that most people are going to be more familiar with, in that if you're worshiping Krishna, if you're worshiping Rama, if you're worshiping a form of the goddess and your devotion is to any of those particular forms where God has those particular qualities, those are sagun forms. Mm-hmm. And those bhakti traditions have tended to be more in line with the caste order. They have tended to be a little bit more Brahminical in nature. Mm. Whereas the nirgun traditions, worshiping God without qualities, have tended to have more adherence from lower class and caste backgrounds, and there has tended to be more blurring of the boundaries in nirgun traditions between what you might today call Hindu traditions versus Islamic Sufi traditions versus not yogic traditions. When you get into nirgun worship, you'll see a lot of those boundaries get blurred, where the boundaries are more important for the sagun traditions.
Right. So someone like Kabir, for example, in North India is a really important example of this nirgun bhakti. What is present in the writing or the poetry that's attributed to Kabir that's like expressive of this nirgun sentiment?
Well, Kabir, like a lot of the Nirgun poet saints of his time, does talk about Ram, but he means something entirely different from the Rama of the Ramayana. He just uses the word Ram to refer to a sort of abstract God who is beyond conception, beyond any kind of form. Mm-hmm. And for Kabir, you know, he's drawing on not yogic traditions, on Sufi traditions, and, you know, working with Hindu theological concepts as well. So he is kind of merging them all together. But at the same time, he is critical of all three of those traditions. He is very much his own man. So I think he's a fascinating case study. And in the course, I actually spend quite a bit of time in one session talking about Kabir, because I think he's so fascinating. His poetry really, I always teach, give a whole class session in my intro Hinduism class on Kabir, because he's such a compelling figure for students. They really can, he really connects with a modern sensibility in the way that he talks about religion, in the way he understands kind of spirituality before the sort of distinction between spirituality and religion was even articulated in the way we talk about it today. He was kind of already articulating it and was skeptical of some of the, what you might today say, organized religion. And he thought we should just turn inward and get to know the God within. You don't need pilgrimages for that. You don't need these different ritual practices.
You don't even need yoga, right? He's got some real shots that he takes at the yogis and the hatha yogis. What is one of those lines he has? Oh, brother, never have I seen such yogis, kind of roaming around. You know, does he take a shot at some of the armed kind of warrior yogis in this poem?
And what he's really concerned with in those examples is just the kind of, and this is still something that applies in the modern day, but kind of where you're kind of wearing spirituality as if it's, you know, just some clothing that makes you look cool or that gives you a certain authority. So sort of you have all the trappings of a yogi.
Right. But you got the Lululemon pants and you've got the mala beads.
Exactly. He was critiquing exactly what he saw as just complete hypocrisy in the authoritative figures in both the Hindu and the Muslim traditions, which were the two dominant traditions when he was living. Mm-hmm. He saw them as just sort of completely hypocritical. They were speaking about all this spirituality, but they weren't really living it. And you could see that in the way they interacted with each other, and in just the way they lived their lives. So he did not hesitate to point out that hypocrisy and criticize it. And he does it his poetry is really enjoyable to read. And even as I say that, I have to emphasize that I'm talking about reading poetry, but he was singing songs. Mm-hmm. This stuff that was meant to be heard, and he was composing it orally, and it was picked up by traveling singers, and his songs were performed live in, you know, village settings, and that's how people experienced it. So we can read it today and it's still good to be read as poetry, but we shouldn't ever forget that to hear a Kabir sung to music and the rhythms and of music in a crowd and have that social effervescence. If you can imagine that experience, that's crucial to understanding the power of these forms of devotion. These aren't just words on a page, you know?
That's such a great point. And with the Kabir Panth and Kabir tradition, there is this living performative tradition of musicians and incredible singers and performers who to this day, you know, sing in these incredibly passionate, enlivened performances of the songs of Kabir. I encourage folks, you can just on YouTube, you know, look up some of these singers. But again, yeah, emphasizing the embodied, the performative, and the musical, the oral aspects of the bhakti traditions is I think what stands out. And that, so this is kind of the example of the Nirgun in Kabir. and who speaks about the formless God kind of beyond all of the physical and material trappings. But on the other hand, this, you know, the Sagun, which you kind of said was a little bit more orthodox in some ways, a little bit more Brahminical and caste oriented. Can you give us a little bit of the flavor of, you know, of one of those traditions, and how, you know, kind of a Sagun Bhakta might orient?
Well, okay. So another example that I talk about in the course that I, two, I talk about Mirabai and I talk about Tulsidas. Tulsidas was a Brahmin and he lived in Benares, and Kabir also lived in Benares, but he was a Shudra, so of a very low caste. So they're interesting to juxtapose to one another because they lived in the same place. They were both what are considered today to be part of North India's bhakti devotional tradition, but they came from such different social backgrounds. Mirabai is one of the most well-known kind of bhakti saints throughout all of India. Even though she's from North India, she's remembered as a Rajasthani queen who was sort of forced into a arranged marriage. But once she got into the marriage, she wasn't into it. She was only devoted to her true love, Krishna. And so the thing that you can really get with Sagun bhakti is if bhakti is about relationship, right? It's really hard to relate to a formless, qualityless divine. Sort of like on the philosophical level, it may be easy to think about God as abstract and formless. But when you start to, if bhakti is in some level all about love, how do you cultivate love? You need to cultivate that in relationship. You have to love something with qualities. And that's where I really feel there's a value and a power in the Sagun side. And I should say that Tulsidas is actually the master of this point, but he's pretty emphatic, and all the other Sagun bucks agree with him, that the formless, qualityless side, the Nirgun side, is just the other side of the coin. So they never would disacknowledge that God is ultimately formless. So this is that ancient Indian concept, Hindu concept of Brahman, right? Mm-hmm. That there's this pervasive kind of ultimate reality, the ground of all being. And that is, you know, at the final ultimate level, that is the nature of God. But that God for them takes form. And when that God takes form, that's when you can have relationships with it that are infused with emotion. And that sort of cultivating that emotion and sort of, to put this almost in Sufi terms, kind of purifying one's own love. The idea being that you love God and that love starts off as a love that's tainted in some sense by one's own ego desires, selfish desires of this or that kind. And that through devotional practice, one can purify, empty out the ego from one's own love to make it a pure divine love. So I think that really comes in with Sagun forms of bhakti in particular, whereas an interesting distinction is in the Nirguna traditions, they don't have the same acceptance for Sagun forms of devotion that the Sagun has for Nirgun, if that makes sense. And you almost see potentially some Islamic influence there, but they often aren't willing to consider that God can be in form, that God just has to be qualityless, formless, and it's an insult to God in some sense to imagine that you can, that God would take a singular form with, you know, distinctive qualities, because he's beyond human concepts. So that's something I take up at certain points in the book, that distinction, but I think it's an interesting one.
So this is something, you know, that there'll be a lot of focus on in the course, which is called A History of Yoga and Devotion. So let's start kind of thinking about how bhakti exists vis-a-vis yoga. You know, how does bhakti and these devotional traditions relate to yoga? You know, we often hear about, you know, a bhakti yoga tradition. Is there a bhakti yoga tradition? we'll kind of start there, but then, kind of follow-up question, we've kind of already hinted at this a little bit, like in the words of Kabir, is, are yoga and bhakti ever at odds with one another?
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about with those questions. Those are great questions. Which one would you like me to tackle first?
Well, let's start by just thinking about, if I just were asked you, how does, what's the relationship, would you say, between bhakti and yoga kind of overall?
I think there is no one relationship. That's what both my book and this course are all about, is trying to trace out the different relationships between bhakti and yoga in different traditions and at different points in time in Indian history. So with that being said, one thing I try to point out is that for most of Indian religious history, I think bhakti, devotional forms, modes of religion were completely intertwined with yoga, yogic practice. There could be kind of different emphases for different individuals and different traditions. So, someone might practice yoga with a kind of devotional bent, or someone might be, practice devotion and, some aspects of yogic practice might be a part of that devotion, but they were completely intertwined, I think, in the ancient, classical, medieval periods for the most part, with just different kind of emphases depending on tradition and individual, but never really at odds. And my book and my expertise focus on North India and the Sultanate and Mughal periods, which are really kind of the early modern period. So very roughly kind of 1400 through say 1800 in North India. And it's an interesting period for all kinds of reasons, but in relation to your question, I think a pretty new and distinctive relationship between bhakti and yoga starts to form, at least for some people, where there does start to be some opposition. They can even be opposed for some bhaktas. And there comes to be this kind of understanding of devotion that's a little bit more of an exclusive understanding, where you don't need anything else except devotion. You don't need yoga, you don't need ritual, you don't need asceticism. Mm-hmm. All you need is devotion. And I think there's something new and distinctive about that, and why it happens when it does is something that I try to explore.
Yeah, so take us to North India. What time period are we in here? During this Mughal period, what's going on in North India? How does the influence of Islam and Sufi traditions come into this? Just give us a little bit of kind of historical backdrop for this time and place that we're looking at. And then what is the sort of, let's zoom in a little bit more, just like what is the shift that you see starting to happen where bhaktas and yogis are suddenly at odds, whereas before they see the earlier classical traditions like the Yoga Sutra or Bhagavad Gita seemingly more complementary.
Okay. I think that one of the reasons you see this historical shift does have a lot to do with the new and pervasive presence of Persianate culture, with Islam kind of falling under the larger rubric of Persianate culture. So beginning roughly around 1200, you have a group of culturally Persian, ethnically Turk peoples come into North and Central India, and for the first time in Indian history, try to set up an indigenous Muslim society. And the first point I want to make is it's important not to think of this as an invasion of Muslims into India. Mm-hmm. This is kind of bad history to think of it in these terms, because the peoples that came into India at this time, they were conquering, and there was destruction involved with that conquering. And they did happen to be Muslims, but that was not their primary understanding of themselves, nor was it for the Indians who were being conquered. That was not their primary understanding of these people, that these were Muslims coming in and conquering us. Mm. There were, you know, India was not a coherent nation state like we think of it today. It was just a kind of patchwork of different regional kingdoms that were used to battling each other, conquering one another. And this was just one more new group that was conquering, and they happened to be Muslim. And at the time, in India, again, they were used to dealing with all kinds of different religious traditions. So the fact that they were a different religious tradition wasn't something different either, because they didn't all think of themselves as part of one singular Hindu tradition.
Right.
They thought of themselves as Shaivas, as Vaishnavas, as Shaktas, Jains, Sikhs, perhaps. Well, not even Sikhs at this point, at that point in history, but Jains. And so I think that's an important starting point. Is the most important thing is these people come in with a very different culture, not so much a different religion, but a different culture that is Persian. Mm-hmm. And the dominant Indian culture had been Sanskritic, had been Brahminical. So you can think of these huge sort of civilizations that you can loosely associate with their forms of literature. In Indian culture, up to this point, basically, if you want to write a serious work of philosophy, if you want to write a serious work of literature, if you want to have any kind of cultural authority, you write in Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. And in the Persian tradition, that language of culture and authority was Persian. So, and keep in mind, Islam doesn't originate in Persian culture. It originates in Arabic culture. But then as Islam moves rapidly after it's born, both East and West. But as it moves East, it moves from Arabic culture into Persian culture. These are distinctive cultures. Sometimes we have the tendency to conflate them, but sort of modern day Iran and Persian culture, many parts of Central Asia, some parts of Iraq, is a distinct sort of cultural zone from the Arabic zone of modern day Saudi Arabia, among other countries. Mm-hmm. So as Islam moves into the Persian cultural zone, it has to adapt. It adapts to Persian culture, which already had their own rich traditions of how you do politics, how you practice art, how you write literature. And so Islam gets sort of absorbed into those traditions and changed in the process. And that's the form of Islam that comes into India, a distinctly Persianate Islam. So you have these Turkish Afghan rulers who practice Islam, and they have taken control of much of North and Central India. And so over time, Islam spreads throughout, to put it very simply, Islam spreads throughout the Indian subcontinent. But a point that I make, and that's I think key for understanding the shifts in Bhakti traditions and in the understanding of Bhakti, is that the forms of Islam that are spreading predominantly are Sufi forms of Islam. Mm. So Sufism, the sort of simple definition that's often given is Islamic mysticism, but that hardly explains what Sufism really is, right? Because when you think of mysticism, most of us, I think of kind of solitary figures, you know, that are off meditating and trying to achieve mystical experiences of oneness with the divine. Mm. And Sufis certainly were doing that, but Sufism was a very social tradition as well. And calling it, you know, Islamic mysticism doesn't, when you hear that, you can't understand how it could be a popular tradition, but it was very much a popular mainstream tradition. So I'll pause for a second in case, because I could just kind of keep going here in case you want to steer me in a particular direction.
No, this is fantastic. This is a, you know, this is very complex historical terrain. You know, it's history that today is highly politicized and contested. And I appreciate you starting with just kind of helping to nuance the. It's not just a black and white of a Hindu versus Islam. There's lots of shades and layers of complexity that were going on over a long period of time, and interaction between languages, cultures, and religions. I would say just kind of keep going, but now bring us into bhakti. So the subtitle of your book. Your book is called A Genealogy of Devotion, Bhakti, Tantra, Yoga, and Sufism in North India. So with that kind of backdrop in mind, we can see how all these things were coalescing. We haven't talked as much, but I think listeners will probably be more well known that there was also at this time kind of this, you know, 6th through 12th, 13th century, the rise of Tantra and the influence of Tantric traditions across all Indian religions, but particular Shaivism, Buddhism, Vaishnavism. And that then we have this Hatha Yoga thing that takes off, you know, perhaps around 11th, 12th century. It's debated still. But we have, you know, various traditions like the Nath yogis, who were really important in cultivating the techniques of Hatha Yoga, and then even codifying perhaps some of the earliest texts. So there's a kind of a range of new forms of religiosity. Not exactly new. I mean, they're building off everything that's kind of come before. But I think there is novelty, especially on the yoga side during this period. So you were kind of telling us that you see some shifts in the bhakti landscape, and maybe you were saying one of your arguments, I think, is that there's definitely some Sufi influence here to the way in which bhakti reshapes itself during this period. So maybe say a little bit about that, but let's start tying it into Tantra and yoga and how these worlds are all kind of coming together.
Okay. Yes. So I kind of make a case that the tradition of Tantra which is often conceived both in kind of scholarly and non-scholarly arenas as a very esoteric tradition, and it is esoteric in some sense, but I also try to conceive Tantra as a popular tradition and a very mainstream tradition, arguably the mainstream tradition of kind of the medieval period, that is the period right before the period I'm talking about, when kind of Persian culture enters in a major way into North India. Like I said, there was conquering and destruction. And so much of, for any mainstream tradition, part of the reason it's mainstream is that it has institutional basis throughout, you know, whatever the territory is. And so in medieval India, there were tantric mathas or tantric monasteries. There were temples that were dedicated to tantric gods, or that tantric communities ran the temples. And of course, tantra wasn't the only game in town, but tantric communities, for example, the Shaiva Siddhanta being arguably the biggest and most influential of them all, were, I think, the predominant communities in the late kind of medieval period, and institutionally so. But a lot of these institutions do get kind of destroyed by the new Persianate Turkish presence. And part of this is not to get too far off track of the topic of bhakti and yoga, but there's a lot of rhetoric about the destruction of Hindu temples by these Persianate Turks, mm-hmm. and with the idea that these were kind of hateful acts of religious animosity. And what again is missed is that, you know, Hindus, Shaivas, Vaishnavas, and Shaktas had been destroying each other's temples for centuries prior to this, because that was how you took power from another ruler, because rulers were divinely believed to be divinely blessed, divinely ordained, and by a particular god who had a temple. So that was the royal temple. The ruler would be kind of correlated with the god and with the royal temple, and the sort of power in the kingdom was linked to the god and the temple. So whether, no matter what kind of religion you are, if you want to take down that ruler, that king, and take over, one of the first things you're going to do is destroy that ruler's temple. And so Hindus were doing that to each other because that was the base of their kind of legitimacy. So these these invading Persianate Turks just did the same thing. So they destroyed certain key temples, not all, just the ones that had political valence, the ones that had political power were destroyed as part of the process of taking over. And once the takeover was complete, no more temples were destroyed. That's the general gist when you look at the historical facts of this sort of shift in who's in charge and in political authority. So what happens there is that equates to the end of what I call the tantric age. The tantric institutions, the things maintaining them, like Brahmins, no longer have as much influence, because the people at the top aren't Kshatriya kings and Brahmins, but are now Persian Turks who are Muslim, and they simply don't regard Brahmins as necessary to, you know, to the display and exercise of power, nor do they think Sanskrit's necessary for the display and exercise of power in the way that Indians prior to this had just assumed that it was. So I feel like now it's made out to be this big religious divide, but I want to emphasize how this is a huge historical moment in India's history when the Persianate Turkish presence comes in and Islam comes in with it. But it's not primarily a time of conflict between Islam and some imagined Hinduism, which didn't yet exist. It's a time of conflict between a Persianate culture and a Sanskritic Brahminical one, and new leaders who don't have respect, really, or don't assume that Sanskrit and Brahmins are primary sources that you need to legitimate your power through. So I hope I'm not getting too kind of in the weeds here. I'll try to kind of broaden out, but basically Sufism. So I talked about how Sufism is spreading and how does this influence Bhakti traditions and how they relate to yoga. I think that's how the point we kind of wanted to get to, right? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Hatha Yoga, and I think it's fascinating that both Hatha Yoga and really at least North India's Bhakti traditions are kind of rising up at a time when most of the rulers in India, in North and Central India, are, you know, Persianate culturally and religiously following Islam. So Sufis are doing all sorts of experimentation and dialogue with yogis and with Hatha Yoga. That's a fascinating, you know, aspect of this period. And at the same time, though, they're drawing on the yogic techniques of Hatha Yoga and Tantric Yoga, but they're applying them towards specifically Sufi goals, which are much more devotional in nature. And so one of the main sort of inheritors of this mainstream tantric tradition, once the tantric age ends, I think the kind of main inheritor is this group called the Nath Yogis. They continue on a non-institutionalized, more informal form of tantra and tantric yoga and Hatha Yoga, where kind of tantric perspectives persist through this group called the Nath Yogis. And I think they are kind of a key foil for the new forms of bhakti that come into existence during this early modern period of the Sultanate and the Mughal periods. And what was tantric about the Nath Yogis' perspective is that they sought to, as you typically do in tantric yoga, they sought to divinize their bodies, to, in some sense, to literally become divine, to have divine energies, shakti, to access that shakti, to have it permeate their bodies to the point that they were literally becoming a god. And they did this through yogic practice. Even for Sufis who were drawing on yogic techniques as part of their devotional life, they couldn't really get on board with that. That seemed heretical to say that you're becoming a god. Mm. For a devotional tradition, there's got to be a separation between the devotee and God. You have to love that God. It's about loving that God. Yogic traditions, when you talk about Hatha yoga, when you talk about tantric yoga, for the most part, loving God hasn't been the focus, hasn't been the heart of them, right? You might have elements of devotion seep in, but whether you're talking about classical yoga and Patanjali or tantric yoga or Hatha yoga, devotion, I think you'd be hard pressed to say devotion was at the center of any of those. But it is for most Sufis. It's ultimately a devotional relationship with God, and the yogic practices serve to facilitate that devotional relationship, purifying one's love and experiencing the love of God. So it's a weird kind of and fascinating thing, because the Sufis are interacting with yogis and borrowing from them and sharing with them, but in many ways have a very different perspective. And this is where they shared a lot with the just emerging North Indian bhakti tradition. So you have these early bhakti saints like Kabir, like Mirabai, Suardas, Tulsidas, Ravidas. These are some of the major bhakti saints of North India. And from my view, their perspectives, you might say, are Sufi inflected in the way that they are viewing the nature of God, the nature of devotion, what the kind of proper relationship between human beings and God should be. And it's more one of humility. You submit yourself before God, you pour out your heart and your devotion. Whereas, at least in the bhakti literature, which is sometimes there's some caricature that's being done, but they often paint the yogi as someone who's the furthest thing from humble, who's claiming to become God, to be a God, and who's saying that through his own practices, it's not God doing anything. It seems to be the yogic practitioner who's doing the work. And there's a certain haughtiness, almost arrogance from the bhakti perspective in that approach. Whereas for them, you have to be humble. You have to be concerned about others. You have to leave a place for kind of the grace of God.
Yeah. I was thinking one kind of interesting, wrench or problem in some of this is the figure of Goraknath himself, the putative founder of the Nath yogis, because a lot of the poetry that's attributed to Goraknath, like in the Gorakhbani, he's really more of like this Nirgun Bhakta, right? And he's often and this is something I actually myself, need to study more and look at more closely. But there's moments in the Gorakhbani where he seems pretty critical of the more Hatha yoga stuff, like asana and pranayama and kind of quintessential Hatha yoga stuff. So there's kind of something interesting going on in there within the Nath, tradition itself, along this, this fault line. Is this something that you pick up on at all in the book, or that you have some thoughts on?
I do talk about this at a couple points in the book, and more research needs to be done on the Nath tradition. And it's hard because a lot of these yogic traditions composing literature isn't necessarily a high priority of a yogic tradition. In many cases, it hasn't been. So while that became a really core aspect of these bhakti traditions, is you sing songs, and those songs often eventually get put down in writing. that wasn't necessarily the case for kind of yogic communities as a sort of general statement. The not yogis, there are devotional poems and songs attributed to them, but the problem comes here, it gets very kind of academic, but it comes down to when the manuscripts are from, and most of them are pretty late. Yep. So from my perspective, there are some not yogis in the time period I'm interested in that had some devotional sentiment in what they were doing. But for the most part, I think the not yogi tradition gets bhaktified, gets devotionalized because of how influential the bhakti movement is. So you see in the work of scholars like Anne Gold and Dan Gold, this is more ethnographic work on kind of living not communities, not yogi communities. You see a lot of sant, kind of like you said, nirgun devotion. But I think that's actually a result of the influence of bhakti traditions. And that if you look at the time period I'm talking about, you'll find it here and there, but most knots weren't particularly devotional in their sensibility. And I talk about some exceptions, and you can find early exceptions in Maharashtra, for example, in Gyandev. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sort of my general take on that issue.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's so much more to explore here, but we got to leave some, you know, for the course. We can't unveil it all, or, you know, you gotta read the book too. Can't walk through the whole thing. But speaking about the upcoming online course, YS115, History of Yoga and Devotion. It's going to be a 4-week course. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about what prospective students can expect in this course? Probably a lot more of everything we've been talking about, but tell us a little bit about kind of the structure and what students can expect.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun and very interesting if you've been interested in what we've been talking about thus far. There's 4 modules, of course, and we're going to kind of go chronologically. So in that first one, we will really focus in on the ancient and classical periods. And we'll talk about kind of yoga and bhakti, some broad distinctions we can make about yoga generally means this and bhakti generally means this. And this is how, when, you know, they're quite different from each other when you think about those general meanings. And we sort of set that up to then immediately go and complicate it. But in that first kind of unit, we're going to really look at the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, and talk about if and where bhakti or devotion kind of fits into those texts and how it relates to the way yoga is talked about in those texts. And kind of, if I can kind of address a question you mentioned earlier that I don't think we've touched on, but you ask, is there a bhakti yoga?
Oh yeah, please.
It's taken up a little bit in the first part of the course, because I think many listeners will be aware that one of the meanings of yoga is simply a spiritual method, any kind of spiritual discipline is a yoga. And this is, you know, that's an accurate understanding, but it's almost one that's so broad that it isn't that useful. So when we talk about a bhakti yoga tradition, you're just basically talking about, is there a bhakti tradition? Mm. If you ask me. So I think if you take yoga to be so broad as just a spiritual method, right, then it's almost too broad. So there is a bhakti yoga, and it's in the Bhagavad Gita that we really, as it's usually kind of studied, you get this breakdown, right, of bhakti yoga, karma yoga, and jnana yoga. And so we'll talk about that, but I'm especially going to be concerned with, I try to narrow down what yoga means a little bit so that we can have, I think, a more productive conversation where yoga is very particular early on, of course, meditational practices. And then later, of course, more and more physical elements come in. And all these are designed to, you know, they're in the broadest sense, forms of asceticism meant to sort of change oneself and to, you know, to work towards particular spiritual goals. And part of yoga's great success is how flexible it is and what those specific mental and physical techniques, what goals they can be applied toward. So in the second module, we proceed into the medieval period, and that's when you see the rise of Tantra. So I talk a lot about Tantra and how yoga plays into Tantra, how Bhakti plays into Tantra, and so how sort of the three interface in the medieval period. And as a primary source, our focus in that part of the course is the Bhagavata Purana, which is a really important Vaishnava Bhakti devotional scripture. And it's a really interesting place to study how bhakti and yoga were related in this period, because it's sort of celebrated as this great text of emotional devotion. But as we'll see in the course, when you really dig into it, the bhakti that's being celebrated is extraordinarily yogic in nature.
Right.
So beginning with the third part of the course, the third module is when we dig into this influence of Islam and Persianate culture. And we start talking about the Nath yogis and the Sufis and how they're affecting ideas and conceptions of both yoga and the relationship between yoga and devotion. And that conversation continues in the first part of the fourth and final module. But the last half of that module, we concisely, but I think in a pretty interesting way, bring things right up to the present. So we'll talk about the effects of colonialism, British colonialism, on both understandings of yoga and the sort of development of the modern yoga tradition, but also on understandings of devotion and on understandings of bhakti. And that's really, you know, part of the value, I think, of the course is when you think about the history of bhakti and the history of devotion together at the same time, you see the history of yoga in an entirely different light and the history of devotion in an entirely different light. Because as scholars, we can't help but kind of slice things up in a particular way. But often the slicing up means that we are just studying yoga in its history as if it wasn't in interaction with all these other traditions, but it was. So obviously we're not able to talk about all the things it was in interaction with in this course, but even by just taking one central one are really three, you know, two things, bhakti and yoga, and looking at their histories at one and the same time, I think we're going to really see some, you know, get some fascinating insights about on both sides about what the nature of yoga is and has been, and the same thing for bhakti and devotion. And so the last, very last piece is we take things right into the present. And I think that very perspective maybe shed some surprising light on the nature of kind of modern yoga today and how it's come to be conceived as kind of this thing that can be spiritual, but doesn't have to be, but is almost always secular, you know. It can be sort of spiritual and a fitness exercise, or fitness without the spirituality, but either way, it tends to be secular. And I actually make a case that this very, you know, that if that's the predominant, certainly not the only way of thinking about modern postural yoga today, that predominant kind of perspective surprisingly is linked to these histories of devotion and how we understand devotion and how the British colonizers did. So
yeah, I'm glad you're gonna bring it all the way up to the modern, because I think there's still so much interesting work to be done on yoga and bhakti today. You know, there's been so much scholarship on modern postural yoga. But I don't know, just as interesting to me is the bhakti yoga communities, you know, transnationally, and the modern kirtan movement and bhakti fest, and the ways in which these traditions are being adapted, appropriated, changing, innovating, kind of you name it, the ways in which you go to Rishikesh today and you're walking through the market and it's not an Indian, you know, bhajan, but it's Krishnadas who's blasting through the speakers. And what does that mean, you know, in this kind of these cultural feedback loops? I'm hesitant to ask you this because it could open up just a huge other question, but any just thoughts or reflections right now on kind of, you know, yoga and bhakti, kind of as it manifests today, kind of given your expert knowledge of this broader history, kind of what are a little bit some of your thoughts about what you see in the ways in which these traditions are expressing themselves today, or do you see them as, you know, connected to the traditions that you're studying, or are they really kind of something else?
That's a tough one, and it starts to take me out of my kind of comfort zone as far as my expertise, because I haven't really studied the Bhakti Fest and some of the traditions that kind of identify themselves as Bhakti yoga traditions in the modern period.
Yeah, so, and to be fair, you know, there's a lot of different expressions, and some of them connecting to different lineages. You know, some of them to ISKCON or Neem Karoli Baba and the kind of Ram Dass tradition. There's the Amma, you know, tradition. So many different facets kind of within those bhakti and kirtan communities.
I think one of the fascinating things is to try to parse out, you know, how they are connected to historical traditions, but they also are connected to very modern recent developments in the sort of culture of transnational spirituality, and trying to sort of figure out how sort of a commitment to tradition and an adaptation to modernity and, you know, new trends, how those things are happening at one and the same time is part of the fun and the interest in studying those traditions.
For sure. Yeah, I'd love to see more kind of deep research on the history of kirtan. You know, like Christian Novetsky has some great pieces that he's written on the kirtan traditions of Namdev in Maharashtra, which is like a really unique form of kirtan, of devotional singing and performance. There's so many different regional varieties of kirtan, but it kind of brings it back to, you know, what you were saying early and throughout of the importance in bhakti traditions on song and performance and kind of embodied aesthetics. Maybe just to kind of close here, you know, you in the book you talk about bhakti as a sensibility, and this kind of affective dimension of bhakti. You talk about how a lot of the famous sants of bhakti are not really known for their writing, but for their singing, for their kind of performed bhakti, if you will. What? Tell us a little bit more about that. Like, you know, just what is bhakti as a sensibility, or what is this affective dimension of bhakti? And maybe we can end here.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. I think I very intentionally try to frame bhakti at one and the same time as what I call a public, and at the same time, a sensibility. So first, the public dimension is, again, you mentioned Christian Novetsky, and he is the first scholar to talk about bhakti as a public. And the word public is being used to mean a community that's united by the circulation of discourse. So if that sounds kind of like fancy academic lingo, the idea here is that sometimes we're parts of communities where we never meet the other people in the community, but we still share all kinds of things with them and consider ourselves a part of that community. So the easiest one is like the nation state. And there's this famous or well-known book by a scholar named Benedict Anderson about imagined communities. And he thinks of the nation as this imagined community. We imagine ourselves to be part of this community, and we hold and to hold things in common with the other people in this community. And the idea of the public helps when talking about bhakti, because at this time period that I study in North India, the early modern period, I think that many different people who didn't know each other were of different caste backgrounds, living in different regions, in some sense did imagine themselves to be of one and the same bhakti community. Community here in the broadest term, so or bhakti tradition. And if the key word in that definition is they were united by the circulation of discourse, that's because the discourse I'm talking about is these bhakti songs. So there's a whole tradition of both manuscripts of the songs, the poetry that traveled, and really importantly, traveling singers who were taking the songs of these different saints and traveling around singing them. And so everyone who heard, you know, Kabir, Sur Das, whoever the poet was, the singers would perform their songs or songs attributed to them. And whoever heard those songs in this idea, whether, no matter where they had sort of lived, in hearing those songs and imbibing the sort of moral values and aesthetic values embodied in the teachings and the songs, and even in the way the songs were performed, everyone who had that experience was in some sense united in a particular imagined community. So that's bhakti as a public, but that's very abstract. That's the sort of social dimension. So if you think to that bhakti performer, that singer in the village, and you're sitting there listening to them, that's always where the rubber meets the road, right? Is one's individual experience. And that's where you get a bhakti sensibility, I feel like, where we're all sort of embodied beings. And if you're going to hear this bhakti song, the vibrations literally reverberating through your body. You feel yourself, you know, getting emotional as you hear the content of the songs, you know, these poets, you know, him singing to the musical rhythm, you know, the sound of the human voice. And he's the singer is, you know, yearning to connect with the divine, and you're connecting with the singer through that and with all the people sitting around you. It's again that experience of a sort of social effervescence, but ultimately taking place within your body and forming, shaping the way that you see and act in the world. So that's what I mean as bhakti as a sensibility. Having that experience on a regular basis of being exposed to sort of bhakti song and poetry and bhakti ritual would shape the way that you see the world, the way that you interact, your ethics, the kinds of art forms that you are attracted to, and the kinds of emotions that you think are valuable to experience. I think that's what I mean by a bhakti sensibility. And I think bhakti sensibilities there's not a one bhakti sensibility. They would have varied in different regions at different times. Just like we haven't really talked about the bhakti movement narrative. There is no one bhakti movement. You might argue there are different regions that each had their own very distinctive context-specific bhakti movements. But in the same way, they would have the people in those different regional communities and maybe in different sub-traditions had distinct bhakti sensibilities, the way that they used their bodies, the way they understood the world ethically, aesthetically, artistically, and the kinds of emotions they sought to experience and valued versus the kinds of emotions that they didn't want to experience. Hopefully that makes sense. It's all a little bit theoretical and abstract.
No, it's great. And I think in the course, I think students will be able to cultivate some of this bhakti sensibility. So, hey, thank you so much, Patton. This was really fantastic. We covered a lot of ground, but we're as usual just scratching the surface. So if you've made it this far, listeners, and you're interested in really diving deep into this history, of ideas and practices and sensibilities of bhakti and yoga. Check out and join us for this upcoming course, A History of Yoga and Devotion with Patton Burchett. It runs live from April 26th through May 21st, 2021. And thanks, Patton. Any final or parting words or anything else you wanted to say as we wind down here?
No, I just want to, again, thank you for having me on. It's really a pleasure to talk about all this with you and your listeners. This was fun.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Patton. We'll be in touch soon. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll catch you on the next one. Please take care, everyone. And bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or sharing this episode with someone else. Thanks so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care.